Up next, we have our book reading program, Ohomini Iyotaka, read by Gail Hublin.
The Long Knives Are Crying, a novel by Joseph M. Marshall III. Prologue, June 23, 1920. John Richard Cloud stood, hat in hand, at the fence in the east ditch alongside the road and gazed into a long, wide, shadowy gully that stretched away from the narrow highway. They were on the Crow Reservation, enemy country. He had not seen a Crow Indian for more than 40 years, though he knew they were still around. Something stirred inside him, an ancient, inherent sense of wariness. It was an instinctive response left over from the old days, when he and other Lakota warriors had ridden into Crow territory. But things had changed, and there was no way to avoid the fact that their destination, the site of the Battle of the Greasy Grass, was on land that now belonged to the Crow tribe. He knew a Crow war party would not charge out of the gully, but part of him almost wished it would. He sighed and looked up to the ridge above the gulch where a thick stand of tall pine trees covered the jagged crest. Behind him and below the road was the town of Lodge Grass, Montana. On the narrow shoulder of the road, his grandson, Justin Fontenot, was putting a spare tire on the car. They had been chugging along steadily, albeit slowly, when a tire blew. Justin finished and lowered the jack, then stood and walked around the car to inspect the other tires. "This tire is torn and the tube has a hole in it," Justin said. "I think we ran over something sharp. I want to mount the other spare before we go." Justin was 22, a strong young man who stood just over 6 feet tall and bore a striking resemblance to his grandfather. In April, he had been honorably discharged from the U.S. Army after a 3-year enlistment that included service on the battlefields of France in 1918. A few yards from the car, Catherine Fontenot and Anne Hall, Cloud's daughter, sat on a blanket beneath the shade of Anne's umbrella. "Dad," Catherine called out, "come sit with us while Justin finished fixing the tires." "You might as well sit and rest while I work," the young man said, taking a new tube and tire casing from the car. Acquiescing to the heat, Cloud walked over and joined his daughters. Both wore calico dresses and had their long black hair pulled back in a French bun. Their complexions were fair thanks to their mother, Agatha, who was not Lakota. They had spent the night in a hotel in Sheridan, Wyoming, after getting past a nervous desk clerk who had reluctantly let Cloud through the front door. Breakfast in the dining room had drawn more than a few annoyed glances from other patrons. After ignoring the often comical angst, the family drove north out of town and onto a gravel highway. After 2 hours, the right rear tire blew and temporarily put a halt to their odyssey back in time. Starting from the northern part of the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation in South Dakota, they had driven more than 400 miles in just over a week. In March, Cloud had started talking about wanting to see the Powder River country east of the Bighorn Mountains and the battlefield on the Greasy Grass River where the Lakota defeated Custer. Anne and Catherine had talked him into waiting until Justin was home from the Army. Cloud's neighbor and good friend had loaned them his car, a 1919 Packard. Fortunately, it had 2 spare tires. "This was our territory back then," Cloud pointed out, waving his arm in a sweeping gesture, "all the way to Elk River. I guess it is called the Yellowstone River now, but the whites gave the land to the Crow, maybe because the Crow scouted for them against us." "It's on the government map I got from the agency," Catherine told him. "The Crow Indian Reservation," Cloud grinned. "Enemy territory. We better watch out." Anne pointed south. "I think I remember this part of the country," she said. "I remember Mom and Great-Grandma Willow taking down the lodge whenever it was time to move. My job was to put the picket pins in a bag." She paused and gazed at the grass near her feet. "I remember when Grandma Willow died." "Yes, that was in 1871, I think," Cloud recalled. "We took her to a small hidden plateau above the Tongue River and put her beside my grandfather." "How old was she?" Catherine asked. "Around 80, she thought," Cloud replied. She remembered hearing about Lewis and Clark when they came up the river. She was 13 or so then. "She outlived her children," Anne said softly. "That must have been hard." "I never heard her say that," Cloud said, "but I know she thought about my mother and uncle a lot. She would tell stories about them from when they were children." "Speaking of stories," Catherine said, What happened after the Battle of the Hundred in the Hand? You said it was the coldest winter you could remember. It was, Cloud affirmed. Deep snow and so cold, your spit froze before it hit the ground. He paused, letting the memories fall into place. After the battle, I couldn't do much except walk. It was a month before I could ride a horse without hurting. My cousin Goings and the others kept my family supplied with meat. All of Crazy Horse's people had a lean winter. Men had to travel far and for days just to find deer and elk. The soldiers in the fort stayed inside until spring. When did they finally leave? Catherine asked. Not until the following year, Cloud replied. The summer before, they surprised us after they got new rifles, breech loaders. They could fire as fast as they could, pull out one shell and load the next. We cornered several wagons on the road. There were 30 or so soldiers. Red Cloud decided to attack, but the soldiers held their own. They took down their wagon boxes, put them in a circle, and hid behind them. We charged several times, but we could not overrun them. After several good men were killed, Crazy Horse finally called it off. Is that when Taken Alive was wounded? Anne asked. Yes, a bullet went through his leg, above the knee. That leg was weak for the rest of his life. After that day, though, he never took part in any action led by Red Cloud. He never said anything against him. He just stayed away from him. And Red Cloud went to Fort Robinson the next year? This was from Catherine. Yes, after he signed the paper at Fort Laramie in 1868, the whites set aside some land for him to live on near Fort Robinson. His people followed him. Before that, the soldiers had left the forts, and some of Red Cloud's followers said he had defeated them. I do not know if that is true, but he never fought against the whites again. So after he went to Nebraska, the only people still out here were those who were with Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull? Catherine asked. Cloud nodded. Spotted Tail took many of the Sichangu, my father's people, to Nebraska. I think over half of the Lakota Nation was living near Fort Robinson. So when Longhair came to the Black Hills in 1874 and said there was gold, there were not enough fighting men with Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse to chase out the whites who came like flies to a dead carcass. By then, the hide hunters had killed off most of the buffalo. First, they took only the tongues, then the hides, because they sold them back east somewhere. Later, other whites came and took all the bones. My cousin went along on a trip to Washington one summer, and he said he saw a pile of buffalo bones near the railroad in some town. Omaha, I think. A pile higher than a square house. My word, Anne exclaimed. Justin had finished mounting the tube and tire casing on the second spare rim and brought it and the hand pump down to the ditch. After he attached the pump to the stem of the air valve on the rim, he sat back to rest. In the army, I met a man whose grandfather was a hide hunter, he said. He told everyone how his grandfather would sit on a hill above a herd of 100 yards away or more with the long barrel sharps, a 60 caliber, and kill them, sometimes 40 or 50 in a day. Then the skinners came and took the hides and left everything else. Justin paused, a little anger emerging with the memory. That man was proud of what his grandfather did. Cloud nodded solemnly. I remember a few times when someone found carcasses after the hide hunters left. Everyone hurried to take what was still good. Sometimes they had to cut away some of the meat and leave it. All the old women cried when they saw the buffalo, naked and dead, scattered across the prairie. Then they were harder to find. Buffalo scouts kept track of the herds. They knew all the trails, but after a while the buffalo did not come, and we knew it was because there was not as many as before. The fall before Custer came to the Black Hills, Taken Alive, Yellow Wolf, Goings, and I looked for a long time. Days and days. We came up here, he said, waving his arm, even past the Yellowstone River, before we found anything. But that was too far to take a hunting camp. After that year, it turned worse. We had to travel farther just to find a handful, sometimes only 5 or 6. So what did you hunt? Justin wanted to know. Deer, elk, and antelope. Mountain sheep sometimes, but there was no way to replace the buffalo. The women could patch lodge covers with elk hide, but there was not enough buffalo hides to make new lodges. Still, we meant to stay away from the agencies no matter what. Living free and being hungry now and then was better than having the whites tell us what to do. Justin started pumping air into the tire as a truck rattled by, its driver paying no attention to the people by the road. Grandpa, what about the people at the agency in Nebraska? How did they live? They had to stay there, I know that, Cloud said. No hunting. The whites gave them food, beans, rice, and flour, I think. blankets too, all brought in by wagons. For meat they had longhorn cattle. There was nothing for the young men to do. The way of the hunter and the warrior was over. A few of them would sneak away, though, and bring news up to us. We would send word back with them for our relatives. They thought we had it rough, and we felt sorry for them. Dad, said Catherine, you never gave in, did you? Cloud nodded slowly. There was no other way. Your mother being white, we were both afraid they would take her away if we went to Fort Robinson. So we went part of the way with Crazy Horse in the spring of 1877. Then we went east toward the White Earth River. Yellow Wolf and his wife went with us. You, too, were there. You were born in March. I can still see you in your cradleboard lying across the withers of the horse your mother rode. Justin stopped pumping and tested the firmness of the tire, then glanced at his grandfather, who was staring off into the distance. After a moment, Cloud sighed and leaned forward, elbows resting on his knees. My grandfather would say that life was not worth living unless we had to defend it now and then, he said. That is what we had to do. It was hard for us to find food and stay hidden. We had to be alert all the time and watch for white people. But it was good, too. You girls grew up free. You played along the rivers. You grew up happy and strong. I cannot remember ever being hungry, Anne said. Winters were rough, but we always had food, and you and Mom told us stories. We can go now, Justin interjected gently. In a few minutes, they were reloaded and on their way again. Cloud stared out at the passing landscape. The last time he had laid eyes on the hills and trees here, it had been from the back of a good horse. Cloud lost himself in his memories as the miles slowly slid by. When they finally stopped, it was at a strange gate made of iron, he thought, that crossed over the road. After a short pause, Justin drove through it and followed the road up a hill. Cloud recognized the area, but not the building to the right of the road, or the stone monument at the end of the ridge. They parked beyond the monument and got out of the car. The old man sighed deeply, his thin shoulders straight as he stared at the strange square obelisk rising from the end of the ridge east of the Greasy Grass River. The last time he had stood there, dead soldiers and dead horses were scattered on the dry, dusty slope. Now two large, light-colored blocks of stone sat atop a square base of raised earth. The monument did not fit in with the bristly soap weeds, sparse grass, and thistle stalks all around it. All the plants in the land were just as he remembered, but now there were fences and a narrow gravel road leading up to the ridge. Immediately below the monument on the west face of the slope was a fenced area with headstones. Cloud wondered if the soldiers who had been killed here were buried where they had fallen. It was on this ridge where one of the two final skirmishes of the first day of battle occurred. In the recesses of his memory, Cloud could hear the last rifle blast reverberating down the valley. Grandpa, Justin said, I saw a painting of the battle. It shows Custer with a pistol in each hand and completely surrounded by warriors. Is that how it was? Cloud turned his tired 81-year-old eyes toward his grandson. Justin had achieved the rank of sergeant in the army during his enlistment. He had fought in France in the worst of the trench warfare. Cloud felt a bond with the young man. They were both warriors in the truest sense of the word, having earned the distinction in the unfettered violence of combat. One of Cloud's last battles had ended here on this ridge now known as Custer Hill. No, Cloud replied. Maybe 30 or 40 soldiers made it this far. He pointed to the headstones, where those markers are. None of them were standing, and they did not fire very much. Maybe they were low on bullets. We were all around taking good aim. There were several shots, like the last beats of a drum, and then it was quiet. All the soldiers were dead. So that was Custer's last stand? Not much of a last fight for them. Most of them were on foot. Some were helping the others, carrying them, I mean. Cloud felt silent, staring over the land. The summer of 1876 was always in the back of his mind, like a friend standing outside the door, waiting to be invited in, and sometimes like an enemy lurking in the shadows. Now, with each passing moment, the memories became clearer and clearer. Days before, 50 miles to the south, they had fought the Battle of the Rosebud. There had been other battles, the Hundred in the Hand, the Battle of Red Buttes near the Shell River, and the Revenge Raid south of the Shell after the murders of the Blue Clouds, also called the Arapaho, at Sand Creek. There were more than 50 years ago now. Cloud's old eyes noticed that there were writing on the square monument, and he shook his head. The whites were fond of their monuments, like the one south of Prairie Dog Creek they had seen only 2 days ago. That one had been raised in memory of the Long Knives from Fort Phil Kearny who had been killed in the Battle of the Hundred in the Hand. But the words on that marker did not tell the truth. He wondered if this square monument told the true story of this battle. He turned and saw his daughters. They were looking out over the land. Anne pointed west toward the river. "Dad," she said, "where was the village?" "You should remember," he reminded her. "You were 9 that summer. It was south, on the west side of the river." A thought rushed through his mind. "What day is today?" he asked. "The 23rd, replied Catherine. "Today is June 23rd. A distant look drifted into Cloud's eyes. "On their calendar, the first day of the fighting was June 25th, he said quietly. Cloud nodded as he slowly brought himself back to the moment at hand. He glanced toward the monument. "What does it say, those words?" he wanted to know. Catherine shaded her eyes against the bright summer sky. "Names, Dad, they are the names of the soldiers who died here." Cloud shook his head, turned away, and began retracing the path toward their car. Catherine, Anne, and Justin followed. "Drive that way," Cloud said, pointing south. The road was narrow and fairly straight until it bent slightly west before it went down into Medicine Tail Coulee. From there it rose gradually behind the eastern slopes of the ridges above the river and then opened onto a narrow plateau. They drove another half mile or so to yet another stone monument, but a smaller one this time. "This is where the first soldiers dug in," recalled Cloud. "They were still here when we left the next evening. All they could do was watch us go." Justin parked the car and pointed to a high point farther south. "That hill can probably give us a good view of the valley below, if we feel like walking." Cloud stepped out of the car and began walking across the grassy meadow before everyone else could react. Anne managed to grab a jar of water before she and the others got out too. She watched her father, his strides long and certain. "It's been a long time since he's been excited about anything," she observed. Catherine found the umbrella she liked to use as a sunshade. "I know," she agreed. "I think it's good. But lately there has also been a different look in his eyes, almost like he's looking at everything for the last time." Anne nodded pensively and glanced toward her nephew, who took off his coat and hurried after his grandfather. "Yes, last week before we came," she recalled, "he was on the hill above our house every morning by sunrise. He was just standing there looking around." They stared for a moment longer at their father walking away from them. He seemed to blend into the landscape. After another moment, they hurried to catch him. After a 5-minute meandering walk through the soapweeds, the family stood on the crest of the hill. To the south, west, and northwest was the broad green floodplain. They could see where Ash Creek flowed into the Greasy Grass or Little Bighorn River. Cloud pointed east toward the low hills and broken ridges. "The village was there, 4 or 5 miles away, maybe for about a month. Sitting Bull did a sun dance there. That's where he had his vision of soldiers falling from the sky into a Lakota village. Our horses ate the grass down, so we moved to this spot." He waved an arm to indicate the floodplain west across the river. "The lodges were pitched among the cottonwood trees all the way north to Medicine Tail Crossing." "Yes, I remember now," Anne told her father. "So many lodges. I tried to count them, but the trees got in the way. I was playing with someone, I think, and we followed her dog into the Cheyenne camp. That would have been north of ours." Catherine gazed down at the giant cottonwood trees standing on the floor of the valley. "Sis," she said, "where were you when the soldiers came?" "Mom and I were making jerky in front of our lodge," she recalled. "I don't remember where Dad was." "I was near the horse herd," he told them. "I was trading horses with Goodhen. We heard shots to the south." Justin pointed to a grassy mound of earth. "That looks like a good place to sit, Grandpa," he suggested. Cloud nodded and sat down. His grandson followed. "Yes, we will sit here and I will tell you what happened." After removing his coat, he untied the black bandana from his neck and wiped his face. He gazed across the land below them and across the river, but Justin knew it was not the land he was seeing. He had seen that kind of look many times on the faces of men who reluctantly looked deep within themselves, carefully approaching the dark memories of battle. As Catherine and Anne joined them, a warm, gentle breeze crawled up from the river along the bottom of the valley. It was nearly noon. Cloud turned his gaze east toward the outline of the Wolf Mountains. Suddenly he saw a long line of mountain Lakota and Cheyenne fighting men riding up the broken slopes. He could feel the horse beneath him as it picked its way up the narrow trail. "People forget," he began, "that we fought a column of Long Knives before Long Hair attacked us. We fought them on Rosebud Creek, 50 miles from here, 8 days before we killed Long Hair. We rode through the night and fought them all day. Then we rode through the night again to get back." Cloud plucked a blade of grass and stared at it. "But when Sitting Bull sent out the call, a lot of Red Clouds and Spotted Tails people broke away from the agencies and joined us." He paused to sort through the memories that swirled behind his eyes like wind-blown leaves of autumn. "It was good," he murmured. "When we got together, we were powerful again. When the enemy came, we defeated them. But after the battle, we had to fight a different kind of power in order to survive, so that there would always be Lakota in the world." Anne leaned forward, offering a drink of water. "What do you mean, Dad?" Cloud smiled as he took the jar of water. "I will tell you," he said resolutely. "I will tell you. This is a good day for remembering." And that concludes the prologue.
This program is made possible by funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.